From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. 1 week after her death at the age of 87, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is being honored in Washington, D.C. Ginsburg made history as a liberal icon, and she's making history even now as the first woman to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Earlier this week, Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt remembered the late justice as a fearless warrior for the rule of law.
This was Justice Ginsburg's life's work, to insist that the Constitution deliver on its promise, that we, the people, would include all the people.
The political consequences of Justice Ginsburg's passing are taking shape quickly. Senate Republicans apparently have the votes to confirm a successor and cement the high court's conservative majority for decades to come. It would be a major victory for President Trump, even as he once again refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power should he lose in November.
Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
And another round of protests, some of them violent, erupt after a grand jury in Kentucky declined to indict police officers for the killing of Breonna Taylor. Here's the state attorney general, Daniel Cameron, announcing the decision.
Sometimes the criminal law is not adequate to respond to a tragedy.
It was a week that saw an historic passing, political tumult, and continued alarm about racial justice. To talk about it all, Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe, is with us. Kimberly, it's always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Anthony. Hello.
Hello there. And we're going to start today with the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And to help us do that, David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and has since 1986, is with us. David, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there. So, David, I'll start with you on this. As we look at pictures of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, casket lying in state there in Statuary Hall on Capitol Hill. You've covered her entire tenure. Start us off this hour and talk a little bit about her influence on the court and her legacy. How are you thinking about her?
Well, I think most people wouldn't remember if you go back to 1993. When she joined the court, she was the lone Democrat. There were eight Republican appointees from Nixon to Ford and Ronald Reagan. And so it was not a liberal court. She had been a great women's rights lawyer in the 70s. She was a sort of moderate judge in Washington in the 80s. She joined the court, and she was going to be a liberal voice, but always throughout her career, I must say she was essentially in the minority position. She did not write a lot of major opinions because, as I said, she was one of the liberal on a court that sort of leaned right. In her later years, she became a very outspoken conservative. So she's somebody who had a lot of influence on the law, I think, but almost in a way that Justice Scalia was sort of in this situation. He was frequently angry and upset that the court didn't go as far right as he wanted, but he spoke out a lot, and particularly among conservatives, people, he had an influence. Ruth Ginsburg had a real influence on the law, influence on young lawyers. She was a symbol of equal rights and civil rights and women's rights. But just simply because of the happenstance of the time she served, she was never in the position to sort of lead the court in really big ways.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit about how she exerted that influence. But Kimberly, same question to you. What are you thinking about today as we remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Yes, I mean, David is right in the way that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for the majority of her tenure on the court, was not in the position, because of the makeup of the court, to have the sort of landmark rulings. And so that is one of many reasons why she became essentially the dissenter in chief, right? She often found herself in the minority, but she started after years not delivering any bench dissents. It was actually the first day I covered the court back in 2007. She delivered a bench dissent in a case where the court upheld the federal so-called ban on so-called partial birth abortions. And she really condemned the ruling as being, with the law having not changed at all, the law established by Roe v. Wade. And the only thing that had changed was the makeup of the court, which at that point, besides her, was all male. And that led to the Lilly Ledbetter dissent about fair pay, which led to Congress to act after she called on them to do so. That became the first law signed into law by President Obama. She began wearing these collars when she would dissent, particular collars that led retailers to start selling Ginsburg dissent collars. That led to her getting this moniker as Notorious RBG for her outspokenness. That came toward the end. You know, that came well more than a decade into her tenure on the U.S. Supreme Court. So she found a way, even though she did not find herself in the majority or writing these big, you know, lasting opinions. In most cases, she found a way to make her voice known, make her voice heard on the court, not only to Congress and her fellow justices, but also to the American public.
And Kimberly, I'm really glad you brought up the Lilly Ledbetter case, because that's a great example where she was essentially on the losing side of that decision. She wrote the dissent, and in many ways, that dissent inspired Congress, President Obama, to pass a law. Can you just tell that story really briefly about the Lilly Ledbetter case?
Well, essentially, the law provided that you had to file a pay discrimination case within 180 days of the actual discriminatory act, which is the issuing of a paycheck. Well, of course, when it comes to gender pay discrimination, usually women don't know that they're making less money, that the discrimination is taking place. And when Lilly Ledbetter went to sue her employer, she lost because she didn't know. And every time a new paycheck was issued, the clock started within 6 months of the last discriminatory paycheck. Mm-hmm. So for the tenure of her time working there, she could not get that money back. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg denounced that and called on Congress to change the law in that fiery bench dissent. And Congress acted, and they passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It didn't benefit Lilly Ledbetter, unfortunately, because it came after her case, but it benefited women moving forward, giving them time to be able to discover these pay inequities, which are often hidden. And, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg often talked about her own experience with discrimination. She graduated first in her class from law school and couldn't get a job at a big law firm. And so she was well aware of what that felt like, and she could speak from that experience.
Let's listen to a little bit of tape. Justice Ginsburg was honored in a short memorial service at the Supreme Court on Wednesday. And here's Chief Justice John Roberts.
The court was her family, too. This building was her home, too. Of course, she will live on in what she did to improve the law and the lives of all of us. And yet, still, Ruth is gone, and we grieve.
David Savage, what were the expectations when she was first confirmed with bipartisan support? And how did she evolve, I guess, on the court is a question I want to ask.
Well, as I say, when she was confirmed, there had been a 26-year period where there are no Democratic appointees. Thurgood Marshall was the 1967 was. So there had been this long period of Republican nominees. And so early on, and through much of her tenure, she and the other liberal justices were really fighting a holding action. You know, in other words, Roe versus Wade has been under attack from the right since the 70s and 80s. And she and the other liberal justices, and sometimes allied with Sandra O'Connor or Anthony Kennedy, were trying to maintain a sort of moderate middle position of saying, let's not go back and overturn precedents like Roe versus Wade. So she unfortunately never, as I say, had a period where she could be sort of a leader of the court in a new direction, but sort of holding the line on a whole series. Affirmative action is another one that was always under attack. Didn't quite get overturned, and so for much of her tenure, that's what she was doing, sort of holding the line, holding the middle for the sort of liberal wing of the court.
And David, will you say more about Roe versus Wade? Because, of course, she was a supporter of abortion rights, but she had reservations about that decision, right?
Yes, that's another thing that's sort of forgotten. She had a reservation of how the decision was written, and she thought it went very far. If you remember, it was written as a right to privacy case, if you read the Roe versus Wade opinion, it reads like a doctor's rights opinion more than a women's rights opinion. She thought it should have been grounded as a sex discrimination, equal treatment, that a series of male-dominated legislatures wrote these laws that had a profound and discriminatory effect on women, and she thought it should have been seen all along as a sort of written as a sex discrimination, equal treatment for women. So she had reservations about the opinion, but she did not have reservations about the idea that abortion should be the decision of the woman, not the state.
Mm. But is it true that if I, in preparing for this segment, I was sort of reading back and trying to recall this, but she would have preferred that legalization of abortion would have come about through broader dialogue with the states, with state legislatures. Is that sort of a fair statement?
I think that's fair, Anthony. I was a little unclear. I remember those speeches. It's often said, you know, that for example, take the gay rights issue,
yeah,
that over 10 or 15 years, the court had a number of cases that sort of slowly endorsed the principle that you cannot discriminate against gays and lesbians, as opposed to like one decision at one time that decides it for all time. I think she thought it would have been better had the court in the early 70s started knocking down extreme anti-abortion laws and sort of moving down the road of gradually endorsing the notion that this was a woman's right, as opposed to one sweeping decision that tried to decide everything for all time. I think she thought, as a lawyer and as a legal scholar, that was not the most effective way to get there.
Well, David Savage, Kimberly Atkins, stand by. We're talking about the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how her loss is reshaping the Supreme Court. A lot more on that after the break. And what happens next in Washington after the break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about a pivotal story this week in the news, how Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing is reshaping the Supreme Court and the political reaction to that. I'm here with Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe, and David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court at the Los Angeles Times. Now, we understand that before her death, Ruth Bader Ginsburg told her granddaughter that her dying wish was not to be replaced until the next president was chosen. President Trump and Mitch McConnell, a Senate leader, have the votes, apparently, to install a new justice by Election Day. This has Democrats incensed, given that they were unable to put Barack Obama's choice of Merrick Garland before the Senate. So here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who spoke to reporters on Tuesday about Republican plans to confirm a Supreme Court justice before the presidential election.
Leader McConnell's actions may now very well destroy the institution of the Senate. If Leader McConnell presses forward, the Republican majority will have stolen two Supreme Court seats 4 years apart, using completely contradictory rationales.
Kimberly, I'd like to come to you on this and get your response. Do the Democrats have any arrows in their quiver left to stop this nomination, or does it? I mean, to stop this confirmation, or does it look like it's absolutely going to go forward?
Yeah, they do not. I mean, over the past several nominations of Supreme Court justices, essentially all of the levers that would have been used to either try to, you can, however you want to frame it, try to block a nomination or try to seek a consensus over a nominee have been broken down over the past decade. It was the removal of the filibuster as well as actions like that taken by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell here, which, you know, let's be clear. Mitch McConnell was changing the rules of the game in order to ensure that the nominee that he wanted would get on the bench and the nominee that he did not want 4 years ago would not get on the bench. Can he do that? Well, yes, because he did. The justification that Republicans are using, that it's some sort of historic precedent that when the Senate is in control of one party and the White House in another, the rules are different. That's nonsense. That's mm-hmm. tying themselves up into logical knots. It would be more honest just to say, hey, we can, because we have the Senate and we can push this nomination through and block Merrick Garland 4 years ago. So the only solution at this point would be in the hands of the voters. If the voters choose to give the Senate to Democratic control, then things could be different, or at least things would be different the other way around. I think there is a concern that, as you said, the rules are sort of broken. Senator Schumer saying that it's really a blow to the institution of the Senate. Recall, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed by a vote of 96-3. Antonin Scalia was confirmed unanimously. Ever since the Clarence Thomas nomination, the Supreme Court justices, the confirmation of Supreme Court justices became political. It's a fairly recent development. Usually the thought was presidents had the right to choose who they wanted, and unless there was something wrong with them, if they were unqualified, unless that, then they would be confirmed.
And in terms, David, in terms of just how political this has become, I was thinking about this, that public polling shows that Americans still have a relatively high regard for the high court. And I'm wondering if this kind of politicization of the whole process of appointing justices and everything that's going on leading up to the next confirmation is going to shake that confidence in the court. What's your thought about that?
I think it's quite possible, Anthony. I think over the next 6 weeks, there's a possibility we'll have a situation where the Democrats will win big in the November election. They may well oust Donald Trump. They may well take control of the Senate. But the Supreme Court for the next generation will be in the hands of conservatives. And then you'd have a 6-3 conservative court. Still, the oldest member of the court would be Justice Breyer, one of the three liberals. So you'd have a sort of built-in, very strongly conservative court. And then I guess I don't know how it'll play out, but I think it's quite possible, as you suggested, that if that court then, for example, strikes, that Congress passes climate change laws and a conservative court strikes them down, there's going to be a whole series of progressive bills go through Congress if the Democrats take control. And you could have a Supreme Court sort of like the 1930s standing in the way and saying, no, you can't do that. We're going to knock that down. And yes, I do then I think there would be a strong public reaction to say people will no longer support the Supreme Court as, you know, sort of a balanced and legitimate.
Now, the President Trump's advisors expect him to select Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. She's a favorite of anti-abortion conservatives. So, David, I mean, that leads to inevitable concerns by many liberals that Roe v. Wade is going to go down in this next court. Is that a given, or how do you analyze that?
It's not quite a given, but close. I do think this is a court almost set up to sort of strong conservatives, people who believe in so-called originalism. They never liked Roe versus Wade. They don't like the result. I also think it could happen relatively soon because there's about a dozen states that have passed essentially bans on abortion, either total bans or bans that take place over a couple weeks, you know, 12 weeks of a pregnancy. So those Republican states are going to push those cases to the Supreme Court. Those laws will be blocked by lower court judges, but then they'll come up to the Supreme Court. And I think it's quite likely that the court will start upholding some of those laws. And very quickly, you then get the question is, should we, six conservative flatly overturn Roe versus Wade as wrongly decided and essentially send the whole issue back to the states?
Well, David Savage, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us today. Supreme Court reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much, David. It's really great.
Thank you, Anthony.
And let me introduce John Harris. He's a founding editor of Politico, and he joins us now to talk a little bit about the sort of political implications of all this. Kimberly Atkins is still with us. John, good to have you.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Let me start this question with you. I mean, can you talk a little bit about just how quickly this political battle over the vacancy has taken shape and how fast the Republicans are moving on this? What's your response to that?
Well, it's in keeping with the spirit of the age. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, it took, by my count, about 90 minutes for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to say we're going to push for a vote on President Trump's nominee. I think it's in keeping with the kind of hyper-partisan and hyper-accelerated nature of our politics in this age.
Yeah. What do you think, Kimberly? You know, and I wanted to actually ask you the same question that I asked David before he left, and that is just what this does, this hyper-politicization does to public confidence in the high court.
Well, I think we're already seeing confidence begin to be eroded in the court. As you pointed out, the Supreme Court and the judiciary in general have always been held in higher regard by the public. If you look at Gallup and Pew polls, than the other two branches of government, but that has started to fall in recent years, and it coincides, as I said, with the fact that Supreme Court confirmations have become so much more contentious and so much more politicized. The Chief Justice John G. Roberts, is not just the Chief Justice; he's also the chief institutionalist of this court, and has worked to try to protect the court as an institution against things like this perception that it has a political influences to it, and that it is anything other than trying to interpret the Constitution and federal law. But that has become more difficult. And as the court shifts ideologically farther to the right with this next nominee tomorrow, it will be even more difficult for him to do that, because he will no longer sit sort of ideologically at the center of the court.
Hmm. I'm wondering, and I'll come back to you, John, on this in terms of the political consequences. We're talking about Roe v. Wade being vulnerable in a newly conservative court. Of course, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is facing a challenge in the court. So these are issues for which it seems to me Republicans could pay a price in November. What's the potential for political fallout here that could hurt Republicans, that could backfire? How are you thinking about that?
Oh, I think historically you look and see that these issues have potentially enormous impact. If you were to take the sort of classic cultural issue that's been shadowing our politics for the last half century, abortion rights, the activists who are opposed to legal abortion are consumed with this issue all of the time, and it's the most important thing. What public opinion polls tell us is the majority who are in favor of abortion rights often aren't energized by these kind of issues until they perceive an immediate and near-term and tangible threat to that. Seen that pattern in numerous elections. And I think all of those issues you mentioned potentially fall into this category. The so-called strict constructionalists say, like, well, look, these issues belong to the voters. And if you're going to throw them to the voters, you're going to find that a lot of these issues have progressive majorities behind them. They're not going to advance conservative ends. In the meantime, though, there's a lot of people who have rights today who would find those rights jeopardized under more conservative court rulings.
You wrote a piece this week. The headline was McConnell is on the losing side of history and he knows it. Can you spin that out a little bit? What were you referring to there?
Sure. It's really a continuation of that point I was just making. There's always a pendulum in our politics, and in recent years, unmistakably, for ideological reasons and demographic reasons, I think ultimately demography is what's powering this, the pendulum has been shifting to the left. And these efforts to install conservative judges really are a form of declinist politics. Look, we know that strict majority politics does not favor our objectives. So the conservative movement for really the last decade, and I think this is a supreme example of this, has been using anti-majoritarian institutions, or institutions that are designed to blunt majorities. The Senate is one. The Electoral College is the other. The Supreme Court, of course, is the epitome of that. And that's why Mitch McConnell is so determined on this. You know, I stumbled on a quote the other day. I think it's apropos of this and the previous segment, which I was listening to. It's 150 years old, but the quote is, there's a certain satisfaction in coming down to the lowest ground of politics because we can get rid of cant and hypocrisy. That was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that. But I think it really perfectly describes our moment. We're stripped naked, as your guest said, I think accurately. This is all about power, and the rationalizations are the merest fig leaf. And I'd say give Donald Trump some credit. He didn't even pretend to mouth this nonsense about, well, there's a different rule when the president's party is in the majority. He said, look, they couldn't do it before because they didn't have the votes. I do now, so I'm going to do it. There is a certain satisfaction, at least just being honest about it. But I think there's also a real alarm if it's attacking our institutions in a long-term way.
And speaking of real alarm and what the president is saying about this, I want to play a little bit of tape. So here he is talking about really unfounded conspiracy theories about the legitimacy or the illegitimacy of mail-in ballots. President Trump told reporters that it was key, important, for a new Supreme Court justice to be confirmed quickly in case of a contested election. Here's what he said.
I think it's better if you go before the election, because I think this scam that the Democrats are pulling, it's a scam. The scam will be before the United States Supreme Court. And I think having a 4-4 situation is not a good situation.
So, Kimberly, respond to that, because, I mean, here's the president essentially saying, in the case of a contested election, I need to have my nominee and my majority on the court to fight for me in a contested election. I mean, that's pretty much what he's saying.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's essentially the president saying out loud that he wants the final say in any sort of contested election to be made by a court that includes three justices that he appointed himself, so that logically in his rationale, they would vote in his favor. I think this is something that we can expect his nominee to be questioned about heavily during her confirmation hearing, and that does pose a real concern. I mean, that really will put her in the position of, I say her because the finalists reportedly are all women, in a position to have to say, does she feel beholden to the president and required to vote in his favor if she is confirmed. So that's not how government is supposed to work, but it is one of many examples of how we see the president, how he views his office and the government.
Kimberly, you made reference not long ago in this hour that the situation has not always been so in terms of the hyper-politicization of this current sort of thinking about the court. And in recent decades, Americans have grown used to the idea of an all-powerful Supreme Court. We've seen courts decide presidential elections. That happened in 2000, legalize same-sex marriage, strike down entire laws. But it hasn't always been so. So my question is, must it remain so? I mean, are there ways to sort of get back to the way it was? Well, what's your thinking about that?
Well, I mean, there are two different things. There's the politicization of the court in terms of contentious Supreme Court nomination fights and you know, nomination battles like that we've seen in history, like with Clarence Thomas or with Brett Kavanaugh, and really sort of how politics played a key role there. And then there's the way the Supreme Court decides cases. And yeah, sometimes it's controversial, and sometimes it's groundbreaking, like with that ruling that legalized same-sex marriage, in which Anthony Kennedy really talked about, you know, the dignity of people and the need for everybody to be able to be in a marriage regardless of their sexual orientation. And then you have other cases like the Obamacare case where the Chief Justice tried very hard to make it not about politics. And so those things shouldn't be confused, but certainly politics does play a role. You know, justices don't live in a vacuum, and they are aware of politics when they rule. And so we'll have to see what happens.
Kimberly Atkins, David Savage, stand by. We are talking about big stories this week, including the passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the future of the court and the political fallout of all this. Stay with us. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and I'm here with Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe, and John Harris, founding editor at Politico. And we're talking about the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the future of the high court, political fallout from all this, as well as some other big stories this week. But we're spending a lot of time talking about the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. John Harris, I want to come back to you on this political question that we were talking about before the break. And I'm still amazed. I mean, I appreciate what you said about how sort of this has become the way politics are conducted now. But I'm still amazed by how quickly Mitch McConnell got so many of his members in the Senate to fall into step on this. I mean, only Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska suggested that we should wait until after the election for this. Can you explain that, though, why so many Republicans fell into line, given what you said about McConnell being on the losing side of history?
I think there's a difference between the long term and the near term. Long term, I do think that a lot of senators would say, well, look, this is erodes confidence in the institution of the Senate and the Supreme Court. But in the near term, there's no question that it makes red states redder. And in a close election for Senate control, it might well be that this gives Republicans an advantage, modest advantage only in an electorate this divided, but which could make the difference in key states. I really think the calculation is just that naked. This helps us, and the leader wants to do it, so we're going to do it. I, too, was surprised that there was not more resistance. I think a lot of people were looking to Mitt Romney to provide some of that, to join Collins and Murkowski. He made it pretty clear that not interested. And clear quickly.
Let's talk about Mitt Romney. Kimberly Atkins, as a fellow Massachusetts citizen, were you surprised by the former governor's former governor of Massachusetts, now senator of Utah's, to fall into line so quickly on this?
No. As somebody who covered him since he was in the state house before he ran for president, Mitt Romney has always done what was in Mitt Romney's political interest. And in this case, Mitt Romney wants conservative justices on the court just as much as the other Republicans in the Senate. I mean, Mitt Romney has voted more than 80% of the time with President Trump's in line with President Trump, despite the fact that he also voted to impeach him. So despite the fact that Mitt Romney said on the record that he doesn't believe that President Trump should even be in office, he is still more than willing to back him on things that he thinks matters, including putting a conservative justice on the court.
Interesting. I'd love to ask you, Kimberly, as well, to respond to what John said about who this helps. I mean, to be pretty crass about this, who this helps in this sort of hyper-political moment. John suggested that it might... I mean, I see it as helping Donald Trump leading toward November in the sense that it helps him to change the subject from the pandemic, for example, which most Americans think he has handled very well. On the other hand, when you start talking about overturning the Affordable Care Act and taking health care away from lots of Americans and overturning Roe versus Wade, that certainly is a galvanizing set of issues for Democrats on the left.
It really is. I mean, I think you're right. Without question, changing the subject to something as important as the U.S. Supreme Court absolutely will help Donald Trump in these last few weeks leading into the elections. The polls haven't shown a big change. It still shows, they still show, largely show Joe Biden in the lead with a small lead in crucial swing states. But every day that we're not talking about the pandemic is better for the president. On the other hand, for the Senate, I wonder if this is more or less a kamikaze move by Mitch McConnell, who knows that the Senate is in peril in terms of Republican control and wants to, at the very least, potentially as he goes out and his party goes out, in making sure that he leaves his mark on the U.S. Supreme Court the way he's left his mark on the rest of the judiciary, which is much, much more conservative due to his stewardship of those nominations. It certainly doesn't make races like Susan Collins or any of the other embattled Republicans right now any easier. We saw records broken last weekend in terms of Democratic fundraising, not just for the presidential race, but for these Senate races. It really mobilized Democrats in these Senate races. So it could, in the end, be his outgoing salvo, so to speak.
I want to ask you both about President Trump's latest comments about a peaceful transfer of power. On Wednesday, a reporter asked the president if he would commit to a peaceful transfer of power after the election should he lose. So here's the exchange between Brian Karam of Playboy magazine and the president.
There has been rioting in Louisville. There's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
That's President Trump speaking earlier this week. John Harris, there's President Trump saying get rid of the ballots that he doesn't like, and then there'll be a peaceful transfer of power. What did you make of this sort of second, sort of doubling down on this idea?
Well, I think like you, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's breathtaking. And we live in this age where all these things you say, well, that could never happen. That's just not done. Well, it could happen, and it is sometimes done. I personally happen to think this is bluster and that it's something he does to kind of keep the waters riled up, because he knows that his politics thrives the more the waters are riled up. But I don't mean to sound complacent about it. It's breathtaking that a president of the United States would undermine confidence in elections would not commit to a peaceful transfer of power, something that's been going on for 240 years. It's just one of those moments where if you could time travel from a decade ago and say we'd be here, no one would believe it.
Right. Now, Kimberly, Republicans in the Senate have sort of tried to, not walk those comments back, but to sort of, I guess, assure Americans that, of course, there will be a peaceful transfer of power. But what do you think? I agree with John Harris. It's breathtaking. Is it bluster, though? Is there something more concerning than that?
I found them very concerning. Listen, I think we should by now, 4 years in, have learned the lesson in prematurely declaring something that the president says as bluster. I mean, does he sometimes float balloons to try to get a reaction? Yes, but people thought it was bluster when he said he wanted to ban Muslims from entering the country, too. And he spent a good deal of the first part of his term trying to do just that, battling the courts until he was able to install the most constitutional version of that very thing. So I, you know, the president often acts on his impulses, on his instincts, and it usually falls to someone else, whether it's members of the Senate or someone else, to try to stop him. So I take him at his word that he would try to do exactly what he's saying he's going to do.
Boy, breathtaking indeed, and incredibly troubling, I got to say, as we move. By the way, less than 40 days to November 3rd and the election. So a lot of news, a lot of things to watch ahead. I want to move on and leave time to talk about the Breonna Taylor case, which sparked more demonstrations this week. They came after a grand jury did not indict any of the three officers for murder or manslaughter following her killing by police. One officer, Brett Hankinson, was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment. But here's Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron announcing the decision on Wednesday.
The decision before my office as the special prosecutor in this case was not to decide if the loss of Ms. Taylor's life was a tragedy. The answer to that question is unequivocally yes. My job as the special prosecutor in this case was to put emotions aside and investigate the facts to determine if criminal violations of state law resulted in the loss of Ms. Taylor's life.
And here's Kentucky State Senator Charles Booker addressing the public right after the grand jury's decision.
Let's be clear. Justice failed us today. It failed us in a way that it has been failing us for generations. A woman, black woman, was killed in her home by the agency paid for to protect and serve her. That's wrong. There is no justifying that.
So just to be clear, to bring folks up to date, Breonna Taylor was shot dead by police while she was asleep in her apartment in Louisville. Police had broken in to serve a warrant. Her boyfriend, believing they were being attacked, fired at the police. The police returned fire and killed Taylor. John Harris, this is another really, really troubling story about racial justice, about black folks dying in police action. What's your take? What's your read on this?
Well, and there was a very angry reaction, understandably, nationwide. It really sent my mind up to whether this is going to be an ongoing theme in 2021. We've got numerous other cases. The most prominent is in Minnesota, of course, where the George Floyd death took place with a Minneapolis police officer's knee on his neck. I was talking recently with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and he was saying that he is extremely worried about this, that if that case goes to trial in, I think, the spring of 2021, and if you get a similar mixed verdict or a not guilty, he's terribly worried about unrest in his state and probably given the prominence of that case around the nation. To tie the two things together with the Ginsburg case, it's like leaders don't understand what a tinderbox this country is. How much evidence do we need in 2020 of just how potentially combustible this country is? And our politics doesn't seem to be responding to that. And of course, the justice system is always, you never know in any individual case how it's going to turn out. But I'm very, very worried.
Well, John Harris, founding editor of Politico, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very, very grateful.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
It's great having you, John. Thanks very much. Kimberly, in the few minutes that remain, John there was talking about this connection between Ruth Bader Ginsburg and what happened in Louisville and that decision. I'd love to get you to respond to that idea. But first, you've got a good legal mind because you've got legal training. Can you explain, not justify or agree with, but explain that decision in Louisville? Because when you try to understand the facts of how this poor woman died, it just strains understanding to figure out and accept the idea that no one is indicted or held accountable for her death.
Yeah, Anthony, as a lawyer and as a Black woman, I explain the outcome of this case as an example of how the legal system was never meant to protect Black people in the same way, in an equal way. Mm. I mean, so many things went wrong here. The very justification that Attorney General Daniel Cameron gave for the fact that none of the officers, and let's be clear, none of the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death were charged with anything. There was another officer who shot outside of the apartment and endangered others and is facing reckless endangerment charges for that. The fact that she was, Breonna Taylor was sleeping in her home. The fact that this warrant that was being executed was for someone who wasn't even in that home. The fact that, that no-knock warrants can exist. I mean, the police deny that it was a no-knock. They said that they announced, but most people didn't hear anything. They were in plain clothes. Her boyfriend fired a gun in his own home because he thought he was it was intruders were coming in, something that the Second Amendment tells us we have the right to do. But in this case, he ended up being killed for it. So many things about this, and that there is no justice, that the attorney general basically said, you know, no law provides relief or justice for her in this situation. So as upsetting as it is, really, it was a body blow for me and a lot of Black Americans this week. It was upsetting and a body blow in part because the injustice was expected. And rather than being concerned about unrest, as the governor of Minnesota expressed he is, I would hope that officials would be concerned about injustice and work to fix the laws so that Black people will no longer assume that when they are killed, justice will not be done.
Well, Kimberly, what a week it's been. I'm wondering if you can take a stab at sort of tying together these two strains that we've been talking about. I mean, the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's being remembered as a sort of tireless warrior for justice, and this continuing terrible story that we keep reliving again and again and again in the Breonna Taylor case. What are you thinking about?
I mean, it's difficult. I mean, we're seeing the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was an icon for women's rights. We also had the passing of John Lewis not that long ago, who was a champion of equality and racial equality. And we are seeing in real time how there's so much work in this country left to be done in achieving both things. And so as a nation mourns these heroes, it needs to turn to the future and turn to their officials and try to hold them to the same standards of these icons in continuing to do that work.
Well, so much work in this country left to be done. And I think that's a pretty good summary of this week. Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much, as always, for being here. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to join you, Anthony.
Have a great weekend. And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by a group of very talented people, among them Anna Bauman, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Amata, Martin Kessler, Brittany Knotts, Liam Knox, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dory Scheimer, Tim Sko, Grace Tatter, and Sydney Wertheim. Thanks for joining us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.